Hey, good afternoon. So today we're going to continue talking about the cat and mouse game of antivirus and viruses and other malware. But first, some logistics. So hopefully you realize that we have another assignment out this week, which is tricky, which is basically just infecting a file, kind of like a virus would. We're not having you do the full generality of being able to handle any executable, just the one we give you, though we'd like you to do it in a way other than just giving us a copy of the infected executable. Something that maybe could generalize. So for those of you who've actually looked at the assignment, are any questions, comments? Yes?
What exact IP do you use when you go to write machine code? So I tried using parse, and it just made the file bigger and didn't actually change the context.
What type you, so the question is what type you use?
How would you go about writing the machine code?
So I think the simplest strategy is I have some code, a code sample in the hints portion. I can pull it up because I plan to do this. We go to the assignment and here. Has some code which reads a file into a big buffer, the entire file into a big buffer, which is a char star, and that should be acceptable. If you're getting the file to be bigger, that's probably not so much a type issue as a how you're using fread and fwrite issue. Like, you might be specifying the wrong parameters here, like one in size, or sizing one to fwrite is what you're supposed to specify, but maybe you're specifying something else, where you're giving a size in bytes, but you're rather than elements or something like that. Other questions? Okay. So last time we talked about the main antivirus technique, which is signature-based detection. That we do something like regular expressions. We talked about regular expressions because they were probably the idea of efficient to look for patterns, and therefore what a lot of antivirus software tries to do most of the time, because if you want to be fast at scanning, you're going to use things which are regular expressions or something even simpler. This is sort of the power that you can get for efficient scanning, and basically what they're looking for is snippets of things that you find in viruses or other malware. And we talk specifically about regular expressions, which you'll want to know. And once again, I meant to put a star there, and I forgot how LaTeX works. But so you used regular expressions, our example, because we'll have you do an assignment using them, to find a very simple pattern for which this is way more information than you need, and to look at how that works. And that's next week's assignment. And our idea for using that was that it's basically what you can do in about one pass over the file. It's not the most flexible thing. For example, it's not like we can reason about what code actually does. There's not the power in regular expressions to do that. And as we'll see later today or later this week, that might be something you want to do. But you're not going to do that with regular expressions. You're going to do something that's probably a lot slower. So it's fast and pretty flexible. And flex is an example of something which implements that, which is probably not too dissimilar to the sort of customized engines that we don't have access to really, that real antivirus software uses. And I also mentioned that there were some things that where regular expressions weren't fast enough. Doing one pass where everything's just a simple table lookup, not good enough often. And much antivirus software wants to be faster. For example, they might take the regular expressions and try to find fixed length strings in them. So rather than having a table lookup character by character, they'll look up every 16 bytes in a table, see if it matches some known virus, and then do some more sophisticated matching to double check, because maybe some random 16-byte string occurs in an executable naturally. Or they do head and tail scanning. They depend on early viruses and other malware only affecting the beginning and end of files, and that would save them a lot of time. And these are both things which viruses have found ways around. And for head and tail scanning, we reviewed several options for that, where viruses would, for example, insert themselves into the middle of the file and not modify just around the entry point. They'd add a jump somewhere else. And part of the reason for that was defeating this head and tail scanning. And we'll see later this week or today techniques for defeating this idea of looking for fixed length strings, or even maybe the technique still lets the antivirus software use regular expressions, but it's sure not going to let them find a fixed length string and quickly figure out which regular expressions to use. They're going to have to still scan for a whole bunch of things. And we looked at sort of different kinds of patterns. We brainstormed a bunch of patterns for Vienna, and we had some which were very specific to Vienna, like just taking the entire constant part of the virus and making that a pattern. That was nice, because you're not going to have false positives in that. No one's going to accidentally put a loop that infects every executable in their completely innocent program. And if you're looking for that in your pattern, you're going to find it. But we really wanted things which look for a particular strategy, where it's not likely that when someone modifies Vienna to, you know, display their name, that we don't detect it. So we wanted things which look for sort of strategies. This had the risk of extra false positives. We'll talk about some other sort of techniques where we have this goal that a lot of antivirus software has had of detecting new malware. That it's not just about, I've seen this before, let's find it again. They want to save the effort and find things that are new without having to have someone look at it and write a pattern about it. You know, and that might take a couple weeks, and there's a couple weeks where you as an antivirus vendor aren't protecting your users. So they want to avoid that. And some signatures do this. So looking for some of those strategies, like something suspicious at the beginning of the executable, a suspicious jump, which you don't think a compiler would make, that does it. And there's other sorts of anomalies like that you can do. But there are also more general sort of what we'll call heuristics. We're looking for suspicious things. We aren't looking for actual signatures of particular malware. We're looking for things that are off in executables. Things that are besides sort of telltale indicators of things that were inserted by malware. Like for example, a push followed by a ret instead of a jump, which we don't think malware, things besides malware we want to generate, where they could generate just a normal jump. So one way to think about this is, what sort of things do viruses modify? And what other data structures are there in, say, executables? What did we talk about? Yeah. The symbol table. So there were things like a symbol table. There was some other information. There's this header information in executables. And a lot of what viruses are doing is looking in an executable and trying to modify machine code in there. And they probably don't spend too much time dealing with all this header information that we have. So one thing we can try to look at is what they change. What's in this header and how that corresponds to the executable versus what we expect in normal executables. So one simple observation is that the easiest thing for viruses to do, the easiest strategy we talked about, was appending. And maybe we can't easily tell whether code is appended or not. Maybe the virus doesn't even insert its entry point here. But if it's appending its code, or if it's editing its entry point to point there, we can just tell, even if there's junk afterwards, based on it being in the wrong segment often. So one heuristic is that usually it turns out that the code is not in the last part of the executable. Usually there's data after it. It's the usual structure of executables. So it's suspicious on its own if you have this extra code segment, extra code at the end, the entry point goes there, or something else goes there. So if the virus is following the simplest strategy of appending the code, editing the length of the last segment, and putting the entry point in there, we can say, oh, the entry point's in the last segment? That's a bit suspicious. Probably not some, this is not something we expect normal linkers to do. Just because the convention on most systems is that the code usually is in the a segment before the data. Doesn't have to be that way, but that's usually the convention, which is convenient because it means appending viruses are making our executables violate that. And the hope here is that someone doesn't decide to make their own linker and not use this convention, because there's no requirement to follow it, because clearly the executable works when you don't do this, because the virus works. Another thing they might do is add a new segment, and same heuristic still works. Another thing we might look for is that when they change the length of a segment or added a new segment, did they get all the details in the header right? So there's a bunch of fields in the header that might not matter. So for example, in Linux, we talked about there being sections and segments that are loaded. And if the sections are inconsistent with the segments, well, that's not something our linker would get wrong, because the linker actually used the sections. But the virus might not clean that up. So that's something we might look for, is did the virus miss some little detail here about the size, getting the sizes of everything right, even if the size isn't used by the program loader? Like, the program loader only uses the sizes of things it loads into memory. Do the virus mess up the sizes of other things that aren't loaded into memory when the program runs? Did the virus make up a section name that doesn't make sense? So these are things that antivirus software might look for. And so I mentioned that the first heuristic we have was looking for the entry point in the last section. And we already learned last time that there's easy ways of not doing that, that we just replace like a function call with a jump to the virus, like what you're going to do in the assignment this week, replacing a function return with a jump to virus code. So it's not going to be the entry point. So if that extra virus code was in a separate section, this heuristic wouldn't detect it. But we can deal with that if we take a significantly more expensive technique. And this is going to be sort of a recurring pattern of things we'll talk about today. It's that we're going to have code that does funny things, and we want to see whether the code does something weird. The weird thing in this case is jumping to code in the last segment of the executable, because we know that's typically not where code is. Or some other segment where somehow we know that's not where the linker places code. And rather than checking statically, is the entry point there, we can deal with all the ways we talked about to hide how we enter the virus code by just writing the code and seeing where it ends up. So a real strategy that antivirus software uses is it tries to run the malware code in the VM for a little bit and sees what happens. And one of the things that we'll look for is, well, maybe it started where I expect the application's code to be, but maybe it jumped somewhere where I don't expect the application's code to be. And that's a heuristic which tells you, well, maybe something's up here. And this is a pattern we'll see again, is that when we have the virus writer writes code which does all these funny things, and we can't possibly figure that out. Well, we're not going to figure it out. This is not what antivirus software often is going to do. Rather than try to analyze what the code does, or have someone do that, that person or the software is just going to run the code and see what happens. Why would you bother figuring out what it actually does? It also means it doesn't matter how complicated your mechanism is for hiding how you enter your virus code, right? If you're just looking at where it actually ends up in a VM, you're going to find it. Okay. So that's about entry points. He just fixed about that. Entry points and executable formats. So another thing that we mentioned was in our executables was symbol tables. So we have dynamic linking, that if you want to call things like operating system functions, that there's a table of what functions you want, and the linker fixes up this global offset table, so you can actually call those functions. Now, if you're writing virus code, this is actually a problem for you. If you want to insert something in another executable, and you want to call, say, open, you need to figure out how to get that call to open to actually work when open's probably in a library. So what are ways you could do that? So you're writing a virus, you're inserting your virus code there, and you want your virus code to call the open function, which is in the library. What are some options to deal with this problem? Yeah. So you find overwrite a stub?
Or? Yeah, you find like a stub that like would redirect to the library somewhere.
Okay, so one option is that, well, let's hope that the program calls open. And let's figure out where the program calls open. So that would be one option. That's pretty annoying, because we're gonna need to go through this program header and go through and figure out where is open linked into this program. But we could do that. So that would be one option. So are there any other alternatives? And none of the alternatives are going to sound particularly good. I'll tell you that. Yeah?
Just check if any other functions go to the correct library and maybe find a way to edit them. Like
okay.
Anything else links to the library and use that.
Okay, so you're saying look for something which links to the library. So again, we have to look at the program header and that information about dynamic that the dynamic linker is going to use and hope that there's something which calls the same library and that we can add an entry somewhere.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so that's another option. This also involves some pretty annoying understanding of the linker, but it's definitely possible. Yeah.
Yeah, and with something like that, you could always just like tell the linker that this is another function that needs to access.
Yeah, so we could look at, so the proper thing, which all the solutions you're describing, are either look for that library function already being linked in, or figure out how to edit the dynamic linking information, which is not something we've talked about viruses ever doing, but they could do, to add an entry. Which means we need to hope there's space for an entry or figure out how to make extra space in the executable. Like if there's a dynamic linking table here, might need to make it bigger. And we need to also edit our virus code to refer to that correctly. But it's possible. So are there any other solutions we could use? Yeah.
Adding your own let's add the
link to it. Okay, so another option is, why are we dynamic linking? Let's statically link that library function into our virus. So if we can hopefully know some implementation of open that works, we could put it in our virus statically. And that is an easy solution, which sometimes works. So the problem here is you have to, first of all, you need to get a copy of the implementation. But fortunately, you have one because it's in the library. Even if it's usually only dynamically linked. So you have the code there. The other issue is a portability question. And this varies a bit. So this is re-implement the library call yourself. So on Linux, this is actually pretty straightforward. On Linux, most of the library calls translate into system calls, which Linux has actually made some promise about not changing. Linux actually wants statically linked binaries to work. But this is not true on Windows. On Windows, yes, you can do this, but for something like open, the Windows equivalent of open, which is like open file A or something like that, Windows doesn't document for you what the system call is and has been known to change the system call between versions of Windows. So yes, this is a real strategy on Windows, but you're likely to make your virus not so portable. It might break in Windows 11 because they might change how system calls work, which they can get away with because on Windows they assume statically link binaries? Nope, you can't do that. You at least need to dynamically link our library for talking to the OS. We're not going to guarantee anything about how it's implemented. So there's another option, which is to do some of the work of the dynamic linker yourself. And typically, there are relatively straightforward functions for this that you can get an implementation of. So rather than modify the executable to change the dynamic linking information, which is the most straightforward option, just do what would happen with the linker normally, we can do what the dynamic linker would do to load the file and find the function. And it turns out there's usually functions to help you do this, so you just load a you just copy in a library that does this. And this is the most common technique, is that you look up the function at runtime by name. But a problem with this, with both cases, is that viruses are calling functions by name. So either they're calling them by name because they've modified the dynamic linking tables, or they're calling them by name because they're looking for a particular function name other ways. They're only not calling them by name if they're actually taking the implementation themselves and putting them in there, which is not so portable, and also makes your virus a lot bigger. So something that antivirus software will do is say, what functions does this executable call? Some of them might be a little suspicious. Also, does it call it in a normal way? So if the virus is not adding to the dynamic linking table, well, then it's gonna might have a copy of the string open file A in it, which would not be normal, right? Because usually that would end up in the dynamic linking table. So if they're taking this shortcut to avoid, so they can just have this code be self-contained, then they're going to have this telltale sign that, this code probably names a library function inside of it, even though that's not normally where you put library function names. So does that heuristic make sense, what we're looking for here? Just looking for either the name either in some funny dynamic linker information, or more commonly, the code itself will load the library manually and have the name embedded. Because that's the most portable solution. So a thing you might look for is, do I see a code which has a list of the functions you need to implement a virus in somewhere? If I see that, well, that's probably suspicious. So this was a heuristic which worked for a while, mainly because virus authors really didn't want to modify dynamic linking tables to hide this sort of information, so they used this strategy where they embedded the names themselves rather than trying to blend in with the executable well, and didn't really want to re-implement the library call because that didn't work on Windows. But they eventually figured out how to hide names. So what's a way you could hide the names so I can't just look for the strings? Yeah. So we could write it just not as a string. So we could write it in some other format and then decode it at runtime before we need to use it, before we actually look in the library file and find the address, which is what they're doing. They know the library's already linked in, they just have the name stored there and they look at the table of names, the symbol table. That's relatively easy to implement, and it's easier than trying to modify the executables, dynamic linking tables, where there might not even be enough space. So we can store it in another form. And the most common approach, which is even more devious than like storing it in as a hexadecimal string, is taking a hash of the name. You don't need to reverse it because you're just checking if something matches. So they just go through the list of names in the loaded library, and that's the symbol table in that loaded library to figure out the address of a particular name. And they can just scan the list for the names based on whether it matches the hash. And if there's a hash collision, well, it probably won't happen. So you broke your malware. And this has a nice bonus for the virus author, which is that they made analysis harder. Now you don't have names in there. And in fact, you don't have something which you can reverse into a name. Which means that if you're looking at this assembly code, you're going to see, what is this? What is this random number? And you'll have to spend some time figuring it out. It's a good bonus. So those were a bunch of heuristics based on sort of suspicious things in executables. We either had suspicious ways that code got run, either based on where entry points are or where code ended up running when we ran it in a VM for a while. And we had suspicious sort of function names that were not in the place where we expected dynamic linking to happen because it's inconvenient for viruses to properly modify the executable. These are all things which are where, you know, if the virus could really understand how to write executables like as well as the linker did and figure this out in an already generated executable, you wouldn't get anything. But because they're taking shortcuts, because they don't want to write code which parses all the things that the linker understands, that we have these heuristics which sometimes work for finding malware. These are a bit unreliable because they look for things which maybe real programs do. I mean, maybe I don't use a normal linker, so I have my code in the last segment. Maybe I choose which version of a library to use at runtime, so I have function names in my program, rather than using the normal dynamic linking mechanism. So there's reasons why these heuristics might trip up on a normal executable. So the sort of holy grail of the sort of antivirus detection is looking at behavior. So this is something where we can't trip up. We're going to look for things which are actually bad, rather than things which are weird and, you know, indicate shortcuts being taken. So there are a bunch of things that malware does that normal executable doesn't, like modifying system files. Probably most normal executables shouldn't be doing that. You know, overriding my Word program. Normal executables shouldn't be doing that. Opening random network connections to known bad servers. Normal programs shouldn't be doing that. And we can just look for this behavior. And we don't even need to do anything funny with reading executable formats. As an antivirus software maker, you just need to get the cooperation of the OS and say, tell me when these things happen. So that's a common antivirus technique. You should just monitor the entire system for system files being modified, for executables being modified, for network connections to suspicious places being opened. And usually, this is a pretty reliable way of finding even new malware, because new viruses, they're going to want to change executables. Stuff which ransomware is going to want to communicate with some weird server somewhere to send out the key. But there is still a problem with false positives. And a classic example is installers. Installers are probably going to modify executables. Maybe even system files. That's normal. But this is a very attractive technique because it's so good at not getting wrong. Yeah?
So if it's just monitoring for problems, how do you stop those problems from occurring?
OK, so the question is, if we're just monitoring, which is what my slide says, how do we stop them from occurring? So right now, I've only been talking about detection, not action. So, but if you're monitoring, probably the same mechanisms that let you monitor let you stop. So the same sort of mechanism which lets you check if someone's modifying a system file probably lets you stop that modification from happening and say, kill the program that's doing it. And that would be the sort of mechanism you would use. Or at least would let you like have a backup of the system file. Yes. Okay, so that's sort of an overview of a bunch of sort of what I would call heuristic techniques. They're heuristic because we're not looking for some particular known piece of malware, and we're taking signs that they're there. So we're looking at these shortcuts and infection behavior. So they're actually bad behavior, and these shortcuts where executables look weird. And to give a more concrete example, it's hard to find like list of what antivirus software actually does. So let's take an academic example from a research paper on finding Android malware. And they wanted to do this sort of heuristic-based detection, that they look for things that weren't based, they look for things that they could find without running a program even, so they couldn't use behavior, but they could get pretty close. And they just wanted to guess whether things were malware based on that. And they looked at, so they were looking at mobile phone apps, so they looked at hardware requirements, which were conveniently expressed because these were things which had to be installed in something like an app store. When on a mobile phone, it has to know whether it can run. Permissions, because that's something that we now have with apps, which it tells us a lot about what the application can do. They look at when it tried to run, whether it's had something set up to run in response to, say, a push notification from the web or into the background, whether that code existed. They looked at API calls. So just like we talked about looking at library functions, they looked at this malware and said, what API calls does it use? Does it have the calls to make SMSs, to modify files? And they looked at the machine code bundle to see if there were network addresses in there. So they could see if there was a suspicious server it was talking to that was unusual. And a big problem with looking at these features without running is that, well, maybe the application generates code at runtime, so you can't actually see the API calls. Maybe it generates a new API call, like we talked about storing a hash of a function name. So they also tried to detect dynamic code generation. And their strategy, being crazy academics, was to put this all into some statistics. What people call machine learning, I will call statistics because it's not really that great. And determine a score. So this is an example of sort of heuristics you might use to identify malware. And you could imagine doing something similar for desktop executables. You can try to see things you can easily find out about executables without running them or without running them much. And see if they're suspicious based on that. Might not be a definite indicator, but it tells you something. Now, they had a big advantage, which is that Android uses Dalvik bytecode. Dalvik is basically almost Java. So it doesn't use machine code. It uses this bytecode, which is meant for a higher level language. So this is one of those languages VMs. So this machine code here like understands what objects are. And that makes it much easier to analyze. That's why they could easily find all the API calls, because like there's a notion of function calls in this machine code, rather than you having to guess what's a function and what's some other sort of junk. And their accuracy was 94%, which they thought was good. I'm not sure. With a 1% false positive rate, that's why I'm not sure. Maybe if that was lower. But that gives you an idea of what's sort of possible here. And that compared kind of favorably to the best commercial solution, though I note that they're not doing any signatures. So whereas the best commercial solution probably has signatures like for the most common pieces of malware with like snippets of their code, they had no such thing. They're working entirely on these attributes here, none of which are snippets of code. This is how well you can do with just these sort of guesswork things. And there's some other big caveats here. So one thing is that they needed a training set to do this. And this makes it hard to interpret how these sorts of heuristic approaches are. Because if you have a training set or any example set you use to evaluate it, you don't know whether it's typical of the future. And it's worse in this case than other cases. So like in the normal world, you think about having like a training set, like what people typically do on Twitter. Like that's something where you imagine, yeah, that changes over time. So maybe the conclusions I make now based on something where I look at language on Twitter will be different in the future. But for malware, this is much, much worse. And the problem is this cat and mouse game. That the attackers are gonna know you're doing this, and they're gonna deliberately change in response, assuming your solution gets popular. So it's not just that things are changing, it's that they're changing based on what you're doing in particular. That's not so great on these solutions. So any questions about sort of all these sort of guessworky heuristic mechanisms for looking for malware? Yeah.
When you say that they like run it in the VM, do they like would an antivirus software like would they do that on in their own like research lab, or would they like definitely need to have a computer and like in the background be running it?
The indications are, and for reasons we'll talk about later, probably today, that this is actually a feature of antivirus software that runs on consumer machines. Is that they actually run, yes, executables for some time in a VM to look for things. Yes, it is not an efficient technique. Okay. So now that we've looked at antivirus techniques, we're going to look at them with an eye towards anti-antivirus. And we started with signature-based detection. And there's a related problem, which is how do I make signatures? And we're going to look at a bunch of techniques which are designed to make signatures not work so well and to make it harder to produce signatures. When I'm talking about producing signatures, the way we talked about producing signatures for, say, Vienna, was that we understood how Vienna worked, that we needed to actually analyze it a bit to know like what parts of it are constant and things like that to produce a signature. So many techniques will be aimed at making this analysis harder, this usually manual analysis harder. And in the process, they'll also make it just harder to even have a signature. Make the pattern you need to match more complicated. So let's look at our anti-antivirus techniques. So we have some simple things we've already talked about. So one is blend in. Don't do all those things which our compilers and linkers never do. Those were all things that we could use as heuristics to say, this is not normal. Like, don't put your code in the last segment, because a compiler linker doesn't do that on the system you're targeting. And other things we can do is going to be making the analysis harder. Make our code harder to read. So make the job of the person who needs to write signatures harder. Another thing we can do is make it harder to have signatures. And the primary way we're going to do this is by making our virus or other malware change. So any one signature, unless it's really carefully written, will be less effective because it will only match one version and it's going to automatically generate new versions. So either we need to be very clever in writing our signature to match all the versions, or it's not going to work. So there's a bunch of terms for this that Zur uses and will try to use. So one is armored viruses. So these are viruses which are designed to make analysis harder. That they've done something besides just have the straightforward code like we saw in Vienna, where, yeah, it might take a bit to figure out what it's doing, but it's not basically doing it in the most straightforward way. Another type are metamorphic or polymorphic or oligomorphic viruses. And these are viruses which change their code every time. So when they infect a new file, they change their code significantly. The idea here is that there's not a signature, which is a simple fixed string, which will match it. Yeah?
When it changes its code, how does it make sure that it still thing.
We will talk about that. The reason there's three terms here is that there's a bunch of different strategies with different levels of complication and different ways that they actually ensure that they aren't changing the semantics of their code. Yeah. So usually I'm talking about analysis by people, just because it does not seem to be the case that producing signatures is an automated process most of the time. But presumably most of the techniques that people analyzing viruses would use are the same as if you made a program to automatically produce virus signatures. Not that I'm aware of people actually doing this. So let's start with the simplest sort of armoring technique. And the biggest giveaway to manual analysis for viruses are things like strings. So you have your email worm, which tells people to open this attachment. You have to have that string in there somewhere. And by gosh, that, you know, if that's what they see in the executable, they're going to say, oh, well, now I know where you're generating the email. That helps me a lot. So a common thing people who write malware will do is try not to put these sort of constant strings in there. So they might put this string, which they'll then decode using something like this. So they're encrypting it. I'm, you know, air quotes encrypting because, well, I mean, there's no key, really. It's like right there. That you've given them the code, it's not really protecting it from anything besides making it longer to figure out. So, and this is a common thing to do, because you want to like not give your analysis a starting point. Because when you looked at, say, object dump output, what is the first thing you probably look for? So I would think it's function names. You would probably have been really annoyed if I gave you executable files which all had the function name stripped out of them, which I considered doing for some assignments, but didn't. But you know, you want those sort of anchors as a human, which give you nice and readable, and you won't have function names in a virus typically, but you will have these strings. So hiding them is a big thing to do. And hiding API calls by storing the hash is another reason to do that. So in addition to letting you deal with heuristics for saying what functions are you calling functions without putting them in the normal linking tables, using the hash of the function name in your virus code makes it a lot harder for the analyst to say, okay, where are you writing files? You know, ordinarily they'd say, you know, in a normal program, they say, okay, where are you calling open file? Where are you calling get attributes? Where are you calling set attributes? But in this code, you have this opaque hash. As an analyst, you can know what's going on, but you still have to figure out what this hash is in order to know where is this code actually looking at files. So, and this is something which was done way back. So this is something the Morris worm did. The Morris worm basically used this technique to hide strings in it. Didn't save very much, didn't hurt the analysis very much, but it's something that they thought about doing. The malware authors wanted to make it a little more difficult. And you'll observe that if we're talking about signatures, this does nothing. We still have a plenty good signature right here. Sure, this string is completely unreadable, but I bet it's not going to appear in anything but this virus. So it does make analyzing it harder. So if you were analyzing something which used this sort of technique, how would you actually decrypt these strings? If you had the machine code for this, what would you do? What do you think the easiest thing to do is? Yeah?
Maybe like figure out like where like kind of debugging it?
Yeah, so the proposal is just do something like debugging it. And that's probably exactly what you would do. You would run it in a debugger and look at what the result is. And for this reason, it turns out that this isn't actually as nearly as much as an obstacle to analysis as the malware author seemed to think. At least manual analysis, because you're just spending a few extra minutes, if you're experienced doing this, getting the code to run in a debugger to decrypt it for you. You aren't going to figure out, you don't care what this loop does. You're just going to run it. So getting the strings wasn't really hard. But more importantly, this didn't really help us very much. Like, we didn't get rid of signatures. We're still as detectable after the analysis as before. And it's still about as easy to figure out what our code is doing. We can just look at the disassembly and write down what each string decrypts to, which we figure out in the debugger. So can we do better than that? Can we be at least more annoying? And the most common thing done is, why just encrypt strings? Why don't we encrypt our code? So this is a very common form for malware, is that the malware has some entry point where it decrypts a whole bunch of encrypted stuff, quote unquote encrypted, because, the key is right there. So it's not really good encryption. Doesn't matter what this decrypt function does, because we have the key. But so it decodes some stuff and then jumps to it. And this gives you an easy way to produce different code each time. You just choose a new key. Every time you infect a new file, you choose a new key. Now, most of the stuff you're adding is completely different each time. It also works great with compression. So if your malware is pretty big, you can also have those changes from decrypt to decrypt and uncompress. So did this help us from having signatures? So you're shaking your head. Why not?
I said.
Yeah.
You can check for the fact that they're decrypting it.
Yeah, so this decrypt function is probably a pretty big giveaway. And this virus entry point here, this is probably pretty distinctive. So this doesn't really help with having a signature. So because we still need a way to decide this code. So how about analysis? So let's say you want to figure out what it does. You don't just want to know it's bad. So we can tell it's bad because it has this decrypt function. How about if I want to figure out what it does? What is your first step going to be in analyzing it? Yeah, there.
Debug it and then right after the decrypt function, look at what it's currently doing.
Yeah, just open up a debugger, set a breakpoint after the decryption, and dump the memory, and then run objdump on that. So congratulations, you've made the analyst spend an extra 10 minutes. So that's not too hard. And you'll notice that contrary to the intuition of many people who seem to do this, that we didn't need to do things like know anything about the encryption algorithm. Doesn't matter. All we needed to be able to figure out was when it finished. So the actual things which make the analysis more annoying are when the encryption finished, if that's hard to figure out for some reason. We'll talk about ways that of doing that, and that the debugger needed to actually work, which is something we'll get into later. So So for knowing when the encryption finished, you know, we could do things like we could maybe encrypt in a strange order, we could do have multiple passes. That would actually make it materially harder. Changing the encryption algorithm doesn't do anything. Because the easiest technique already is use the debugger to find this. So assuming that we don't need to like make code to that doesn't run code to do it. So let's take a concrete example of an encrypted virus body. So here's an example from Cascade, an actual virus. And you see what they do is they get the address of the encrypted code, which is used as a key. It'd be a little bit annoying. And they move the body, length of the body, to SP, which is just a register. Also happens to be the stack pointer, but still a register. Can use it for whatever. XOR that with the first thing of encrypted code, increment, go to the next byte, and so on. And when they're finished with this loop, they just fall through to the code they just decrypted. So this is fairly simple to implement. They used XOR because it's really convenient in assembly, and also convenient to generate. Because they just, to generate this, you can do the same instructions, basically. And you know, this is the encryption algorithm. So I mentioned that they're using SP. So why did they choose to use SP? Anyone think there's a particular reason for that? Some benefit to using SP? Not a great big benefit. Yeah. So one argument is that the stack pointer, well, that's accessed a lot, so it looks pretty normal. So there's probably a bigger reason, because normal code doesn't use the stack pointer for not the stack. So like this instruction is actually really unusual, setting the stack pointer to a small constant value. Yeah.
Are you sort of changing where the stack is? Because now it thinks that every other function will think that, like, where is the stack?
So we mentioned we're changing where the stack seems to be for every other function. So this doesn't break this virus, because the virus is written in assembly and doesn't care about the stack, or uses something else for the stack. But there is one program which we might be running which does care about where the stack is, and that's the debugger. So this might confuse some debuggers. Because the debugger, you ask for a stack trace. Well, what's the debugger going to do? It's going to look at the stack pointer. So if you run the debugger on this and ask for a stack trace, you're going to get, I don't know where I am. So that was the reason for this. That's probably the simplest way you see to try to frustrate debuggers here. So it's using the stack pointer, not for the stack. Because the debugger, when telling you where you are in your program, is going to look at the stack. But this virus doesn't need to follow the calling convention and have the stack pointer point to a stack. So it doesn't. So we have this big problem that the decryptor code is a signature. But there is one advantage we get just by doing this encryption thing, which is that it's harder to distinguish between different malware. And this is annoying for antivirus manufacturers, because they want to do things which actually require not just saying, yes, it's malware, no, it's not malware. They want to undo the effects of malware. And that typically requires knowing exactly what malware you have, so you know that you didn't miss something. So this is actually a real annoyance for them. So another piece of annoyance with this, I said we couldn't distinguish malware. Well, it turns out that this decrypt and execute technique is not limited to malware. There are real, relatively common commercial software out there which uses this technique, including anti-debugging. just a thing which exists. So you think, who would want to decrypt code, you know, with a key that's already there so it doesn't actually protect anything? But nope, there's real software which does this. Usually the idea is like copy or reverse engineering protection. Sometimes the decryption is not decryption, but just decompression, which makes more sense. But it is also used with the actual sort of key embedded in there and even trying to prevent you from debugging it. And this is obviously really annoying for antivirus manufacturers, because then their user says, I can't run this expensive piece of commercial software. And they blame the antivirus manufacturer for good reason. Yes?
So the thing that you use in anti-debugging, is that more like video games or more commercial software like Adobe's?
It's not clear what the, I don't have a breakdown on this. I don't think there's been good studies. It's hard to study because this is kind of a niche thing to use. And I note that the more quote unquote legitimate packers are also the things which are often deliberately chosen by malware, right? So things which might be usually used for not encryption but compression, but also import support encryption is one common example. So this might not even be things where they're trying to make anything like hard to debug. But it just might be a feature of the software that's not enabled. I don't know what the prevalence is of different types of software. And it's hard to find this out, because companies do not usually talk about when they do this. Also, I suspect many of the users doing this do not understand what the packers they're doing, actually how they work, because they don't care. They just know that they think it prevents copying. Okay, so let's look at defeating signature-based techniques for real. And we had our preliminary, which was we had this encryption technique. And pretty much all viruses which defeat signatures start by doing that. And the tricky part is going to be to prevent the signature techniques, especially the really fast signature techniques, where we're looking for just a constant string, like a 16-byte pattern, those sorts of simple things, the shortcuts where we scan top and bottom, those are the sorts of things that we're going to want to not have work even on the decryptor code. So it's going to be about, we're going to take two steps. So first we're going to have an encrypted body. And the second step is we're going to mutate the decryptor code so these signature techniques, especially the simplest signature techniques, don't work. And the simplest signature technique is we look for the constant part of the virus, or some 16-byte string in the virus. And the simplest way to prevent that is to just change it. Have the virus change in some clearly non-destructive way. And the simplest thing you could do as a sort of an author of assembly is just insert a knob. You can do that potentially less than every 16 bytes, and then there's no 16-byte pattern. And this is a real pattern that some malware uses, is that they copy the decryptor code, but they insert some knobs somewhere. So they have a memcopy, but insert knobs function. And there's multiple strategies used for this. So the simplest thing is you just have hard-coded places to insert knobs somewhere. And this means that you don't need to worry about exactly where any instructions appear if there are multiple bytes. And it's pretty really easy to write. You just have a template for machine code, and you call insert 0 to 10 knobs in between outputting different instructions. And the only tricky thing is dealing with loops and things like that. But you can track the offset yourself to deal with that. The other strategy, which is often used, is that you can parse instructions. And it seems weird for me to be telling you that this is often used, because we've learned that x86, which is where most of these pieces of malware are, is ridiculously complicated. And its encoding is particularly annoying. So why would we want to do that? Why would that be worthwhile? Well, it's probably actually easier than having some sort of template in your code where the decryptor takes up less space. It's more straightforward. And it's not actually that complicated because you only need to parse instructions that you generate. So you just deal with the subset of x86 that your decryptor uses, which you can make sure is a small subset. So if we just have hard-coded places to insert, or even if we parse instructions, if we're just inserting knots, this is actually not so great for avoiding signatures. So we've gotten rid of these sort of constant signatures, but we still have a pretty simple signature. So how would you write a signature if I had some virus that just inserted knots randomly when it copied itself? Rebecca.
You can have an ignore class when checking.
Yeah, so we could write a regular expression where we have, where we say, zero or more knots in between every single instruction. We can even do that automatically. We could, in fact, write a scanner, like a regular expression scanner, that automatically modified all our patterns to ignore knots. But it turns out that this technique, we can be pretty, there's some simple thing we can do, which gets around this problem. And that's that, well, we could just use NOP, but we don't have to. Like, we can switch between, we can change an instruction to a synonym for an instruction. So we have other ways of changing our code. We can swap registers in our code, if we parse instructions enough to do that. And even if we want to just only generate NOP instructions, we don't need to use NOP, we can just manipulate some register we don't use. So it's not like not the case that we just need to insert knots. There's some simple things that we can guarantee work and don't change what our virus does, where we can insert all sorts of extra code. So there's not some generic matcher which ignores this do nothing code or these do nothing changes. And this brings us to oligomorphic viruses. This is the name Zor uses, which I think is common, for viruses which use that packing technique. They use this; they have an encrypted body, and they make slight changes to their decryptors. So the entire virus actually changes. So this is the really effective way of actually not having a signature that is a nice, simple string. And to be concrete, here's an example of two specimens of a virus called Memorial. This is the decryptor part. So after the decryptor part, presumably, is the actual encrypted body. But this is the part which decrypts that and then falls through to the encrypted body. And you can see by looking at these by hand that, yeah, they're the same thing. But they've made some non-trivial changes which are going to make the machine code rather different and make it pretty annoying to come up with a pattern for this. So they've made some trivial changes to instruction order. So they have some template where they say, you need this instruction, choose a random order. They have multiple choices of looping instructions. They just choose one at random. Otherwise, not too many changes. But this is enough to be pretty annoying, especially since the address of the virus changes, so that's not a constant part, just like we saw the address hard-coded in Vienna changing. And this body is not very long, so you know, it's not like you might worry about a signature which matches all variants of this body matching other things by accident, like data in an application. So any questions about these two examples? So probably the way this would be generated is not by parsing instructions, by having some template where you fill in one version of the loop end or another, or one order of the instructions or the other. And this is hidden from the signature because it's in the encrypted part of the virus. So any questions about this? Yeah. Yeah, so this is two different, the question is, the point is showing two different ways of decrypting. So this is showing you, yeah, there are two different ways of writing the same decryption loop, which can be, and it's, the point is that this is easy to have your virus generate. So you can imagine the code to generate this is, you just go through these instructions in order and make a choice between the two versions. And if you make a lot of these choices, and you make other choices like how many NOPs do I put here, or things like that, you can generate lots of different versions. And in this case, apparently, there were enough choices that there were 96 versions. Yeah?
Would it be better, instead of putting a generic NOP, put NOPs that have a variety of parameters?
Yes, and we'll look at that a bit later. Probably not NOPs that, probably not significantly better for NOPs with a variety of parameters, but there's other types of NOPs we want to put in. Yeah. Okay. So Sewer calls these sort of simple fill-in-the-blank templates oligomorphic. You know, they make small changes. They basically have a bunch of choices for how they write their decryptor. They have some sort of template to fill in, and they do it. There's other versions which Sewer calls polymorphic, where they make much more significant versions of their decryptor. They don't have these essentially constant parts with some templates filled in the middle. And like one or two changes. And so this gives us an example of something which is much more devious for people who would want to write signatures. So with the previous example, you could still write a signature, even a pretty reliable one. As long as you aren't making the signature too small, you're going to capture that, yeah, it's definitely this virus loop. And it's going to be pretty long, so it's probably not going to come up by chance, as long as you don't like try to only catch the like inner instructions of the loop. Here, we have two versions of the same virus, and even looking at the code by hand, it looks a lot more different. Like, it looks like it's the same kind of code, but there's a lot more things that look very different. And the key, big annoying thing they're doing is that all these instructions here don't do anything. The virus has decided we're not using BX or DX, so we'll just insert dummy instructions that change those all over the place. Along with some other useless instructions, like CLC is clear carry flag. In some applications, that would do something. Just turns out that this virus doesn't use the carry flag. So they have all this all these do-nothing instructions mixed in with their code, along with actually changing the encryption key. So this is much harder to find with a signature. Right. We have so many choices. And even though we're still following the basic pattern that we sort of have a template with some ordering for how we generate this code, we have so many options for what to fill in the blank that it's really going to be hard to have a nice coherent signature. You still can do it, but it requires a lot more analysis, and it's going to be a lot more complicated of a pattern that might match some places where you don't want it to. Yeah. Yeah, so essentially what the virus is going to do, we'll talk specifically about the more sophisticated way of doing this, but the simplest thing to do is you say, I need to generate this move to AX and move to DI instruction, and so you have something which prints that out, and in between you call a generate NOP. And you have something which generates a NOP, or a subtract to BX, or an add to BX, and so on. All these things that you know in your malware don't do anything because you haven't used some registers. Yeah?
What is this type called?
This is a polymorphic.
Can you open the difference between polymorphic and allomorphic? Is the severity of the changes?
This seems to be what Zohr's classification is. I'm not sure that there's a more concrete definition, and we're not going to try to test you on that, probably, without telling you more. Yeah.
Do they usually pop and push the registers they use for their random code?
So the question is, do they have to like save the registers they're using? So that's only an issue, a question of when does this virus get run? So if it gets run at the entry point, probably not. If it gets run after a random function, the question is, do function calls need to save those registers? If they don't, they're free to use them, because you expect the function to trash it anyway if you follow the calling convention. So it depends. But I guess here, they're clearly not saving the values. So presumably that just means that this is executed in a context where you don't need to save those registers, which is a lot of them. So there's all these variations here. Because we have these huge number of NOAP sequences and some reordering of the non-NOAP instructions and maybe some different versions of like loop endings. And because we have these weird NOAP instructions, we can't just do the trick of making a scanner or a pattern which skips obvious NOAPs. We need to actually do that for this particular piece of malware. We need to know what counts as a NOAP. We need to basically discover how it's producing its different versions of its decryptor. So one thing, one countermeasure, is that, well, you can't quickly figure out that those instructions don't do anything, but it actually is possible to figure this out mechanically. So if we go back to this code, we can say, okay, we're writing to BX, and we can look at the entire assembly snippet as far as we can and say, well, do we ever read from BX? And if we don't find that, we can filter out those instructions. So it is possible to make a scanner which you know, actually found that these were do-nothing instructions. But it's a lot more expensive. Like, we're potentially looking arbitrarily far ahead to figure out, is this really unused? Or is this most likely unused? And then using that as a filter to match patterns. Also, you know, the technique of looking to see, is BX ever used? You know, the attacker just does something a little more tricky with their NOPs, like insert, like use NOPs on NOP sequences on registers they actually use, like increment and decrement, or use this funny XOR sequence to swap two registers. And if you want your scanner which skips do nothing instructions to find these, it seems like you're fighting a losing battle. Okay, so before we move on, I'd like to talk about, so we talked about sort of packers as our key strategy. And when we talk about this more on Wednesday, we're gonna look at you know things which just make more changes to the entire virus. But it's all based on this packer idea that we have encrypted code and we decrypt it. We unpack it at runtime. So the easiest way, and the way that the way that antivirus software likes dealing with packers, is the same way we do it in the debugger. We run the code that decrypts itself to decrypt it. So if you want to find a packer, there's this nice generic technique, which is you run it in a VM for a while, and then you look at memory and look for and run your signatures on that. And this is another reason why antivirus software has a VM. So they have a VM so they can run these packers long enough that they can apply their signatures to the unpacked code. Yeah. So we'll talk about this problem of anti-virtualization stuff later. But this is a reason why anti-virtualization is really important for malware. Because it's one of the, because it's like a very generic technique which makes all these manipulations to decryptors not do anything. If we just run the decryptor, then look at memory, we can use our normal fixed string pattern matching. And next time we'll talk about how to make that still not work. As a someone playing cat, which is what going to be metamorphic viruses. So that's all I have for today. So next time we'll go on to the next technique in the cat and mouse game.